Okay, we're going to do it. Kathy's bringing you a handout on, did you get it already? Is that the? Okay, you have the, that's the last one. Priests and nuns we're going to talk about today, and to those listening out on CD land, certainly say hi to you from the class of 2006. We will be having three more people join us for the second semester, so that'll swell our ranks to about 54, which is the largest class we've ever had. So we had 54 starting off 2002. We ended up graduating having only 50 at the end of the year. So I think you're going to make it, unless some of you decide to change your minds or whatever during the course of the rest of this year. I'm going to share with you some things about priests and nuns today. I feel that it's important for you to understand the people who pastor the largest Christian body in the world, called Christian, that is, the Catholics. First of all, I want to say at the outset that I know there are many dedicated people in the priesthood of the Catholic Church, and I know there are many dedicated nuns. However, dedication does not always mean that a person is correct. Does not always mean that a person is doing that which is proper. It means that what they think they're doing, they are sincere about. And we will see there are many people who've dedicated their lives. Catholics, priests take a vow of celibacy, which means they will never marry. They believe they do this because they are modeling after Jesus Christ, that they are modeling after the kingdom, that the way people will be is they don't marry nor are given in marriage. And they believe that the celibacy, which we'll talk about on Thursday, is the glory of the Catholic Church. So they actually feel you could serve God better being single. Of course, if everybody subscribed to that glory, what would you end up having? No people, because everybody would die after that particular generation expired. So we know that marriage is one of the seven sacraments, so the Catholics obviously still believe that it's okay to marry. However, they would say that celibacy is a higher state. Comment or question? Yes, Andrew? Bible says they neither marry nor are given in marriage, so what will they do? The question was, what will we do in the kingdom? That's another question, I think, for the resurrections, and you can talk about that with Mr. Walker, but I don't have to dodge it. I know the answer to that would be, in all likelihood, you could spend whatever you could choose to spend eternity with whoever you'll be working with. But again, it may be your wife. What if, for instance, a man had a wonderful first wife, and she died? And he marries a more wonderful second wife. So now, and she dies, and maybe he marries a more wonderful third wife, then the third wife might be wondering why the previous two have died. But the point being, what if he ends up with a third wife that is also wonderful? So which one is he going to work with in the kingdom? Maybe all three? Maybe they'll all choose to not work with him. Because nothing says that the wife in the kingdom has to also be subject to her husband for all eternity. That's a Mormon teaching. So what if the woman has actually more character, done more with what she has to do with? She may be well over him. I think we look at how we will be forever from a human perspective, and instead of from a godly perspective. And God doesn't need to be married in order to have a wonderful life of love. And you will be having a life of love working with and helping lots of people for all eternity. I would assume that if two people have lived together, worked together, loved each other, cared about each other, happy with each other on this earth, that in the kingdom God might give them that option to work with each other, love each other, and care about each other in the spirit realm. I'm just saying he might. I don't see a problem with that, personally, humanly. However, nothing in the scripture says that. Okay.
Does the Catholic view tie in the church being the bride of Christ? How does that fit in there with that?
I guess they would say that he's married to the church. I see more of the nuns saying they are married to Christ as opposed to the priest saying they're married to the church. But we'll go on. Celibacy, not marrying, means I will not marry. They give that up. And anybody who's even interested in a girl when he's a teenager and wants to become a priest, they would say, forget it. You know, you've shown the tendency. So they almost have to start when they're young people. I had a really nice friend, wasn't a close friend, but a nice guy. He was a nice guy. And I was told, you know, I was a senior, he was a junior, that he was going to become a Catholic priest. He wanted to become a Catholic priest. That's what he was working toward. And he didn't show any interest toward the girls. He didn't date. He was a nice guy, nice looking, nice guy. But he didn't show any interest toward the girls. So priests dedicate themselves. They have to go through a whole rigmarole, about eight years of study before they're finally ordained a priest. Unlike the early days when they could go through and buy themselves the priesthood. Now it's about 8 years of study. Nuns have to go through a rigorous program as well. They have to be willing to take a vow of chastity and poverty. Chastity and poverty. They literally give up everything they own. When they go into the convent, they sign it all over. And any of their goods, any of their belongings, and anything they have really does belong to the Mother Superior, who's in charge of that particular convent. They eventually lose their name, in which they take a different name, so that you cannot even know. If they wanted to disappear, you would not be able to find them, because you would not know what their particular name is unless they communicated with you. The cloistered nuns, which all of them used to be, go behind kind of barred, locked doors and grills and fences and so on, so that they can truly be devoted to their service to God. I have several quotes in here. Yes, Jacob?
Are nuns not allowed to attend weddings?
Are they allowed to attend weddings? Sure, unless they're a cloistered nun. Cloistered nun stays away from society, and I'll read you the difference between those. A lot of the questions you're asking, I'll answer as we go through this. I'm going to share with you something was in the paper, 1988, I clipped out of the Los Angeles Times. It's entitled, Faith, Hope, and Now Charity. I'll just read the headlines. They took vows of poverty and assumed they would be cared for in their old age. But facing a financial crisis, elderly nuns for the first time are appealing for help. So those who are older and now retired and gave their whole lives and have nothing to show for it, thought they'd be cared for their whole life, and now they're having to beg for their money. Here are several other different advertisements. I used to subscribe to the Catholic newspaper, which was called Our Sunday Visitor. So I got a copy every week or every month, whatever, from them, so I could keep track of what's going on with the Catholic Church and keep up with it. But in this particular one on the back, I saved all the, this is from May of 86, just some different advertisements in here for young women to apply to be nuns. So here's one. Obedience, our greatest freedom. Poverty, our priceless wealth. And chastity, our fullest love. Carmelite sisters for the aged and infirmed. For more information, call them. Here's another one. Join the Corpus Christi Carmelites in their great adventure of seeking souls for Christ by missionary and social welfare work in America and foreign lands. You can write to the Carmelite Sisters, Nebraska. Here's another one, Columbus, Ohio, closer. Sisters of the Poor Child Jesus, has Christ called you to serve him in his mission of caring for the children and youth in daycare centers, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and other apostolates? If so, you can write to the Sisters of the Poor Child. Here's another one, The Poor Sisters of Nazareth, called by God to prayer, penance, and living of the gospel, dedicated to nursing, teaching, and the care of deprived children. For further information, write Los Angeles. Then they have a number of them in here, Carmelite Active Apostolate, the Victoria Knoll Sisters, the Poor Sisters of Jesus Crucified, and the Sorrowful Mother is the name of their group in Massachusetts. Another one in Texas, the School Sisters of St. Francis. It says, is this your dream, to be a Franciscan, to be a missionary, or to be a sister? You can check with them. And they show a bunch of ads and places you can contact. Why are they doing all this? Because they found that women and men in the religious circles, especially the Catholic Church, have gone down 30% from 1965 to the year 2000. That's the religious priests. The religious brothers, who are like monks, they have gone down 36%. The religious sisters, that's the nuns, have gone down 54%. But even at that rate, for this particular time, you have 15,000 religious priests. I believe this is in America. 8,448 religious brothers and 79,876 nuns or sisters. So they're appealing for help. Okay, I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to take you through some of this. And I'll quote a little bit from this book by Lorraine Bettner on Roman Catholicism. It seems like this person has a lot of insights into what's happened to Roman Catholicism. This is not a book for Roman Catholicism, but rather a book against it. So I will try to quote from it to some extent just to give you an idea of what she says, particularly about nuns and priests. And when we're finished, you will see it's one of the saddest commentaries that you could possibly have is that on the nuns and priests. My heart goes out to the nuns who are giving up their lives, who stay behind locked doors, who basically give up everything. And they are the free labor of the Catholic Church. Free labor. They get just taken care of. People usually bring in and donate the food items for them. And they dedicate their lives. And again, if they're cloistered, they're locked away. So they're not bothered. They have an extern sister, a lady who deals with the external, the people who come. And she receives all the goods, and she receives the mail, and she receives any contact from the outside, vendors and so on. They don't get to see anybody. They're in there. And most of the time, it's 23 out of 24 hours a day that they basically have no contact with anybody, not even each other in some cases. So we'll talk about that as we go through priests and nuns. Here you see the holy orders one of the seven sacraments, holy orders, which is ordination. And you see they call it apostolic succession because the priests are ordained by bishops. So it's bishop ordaining priests, priests rising to the rank of bishop, bishops ordaining more priests and so on. And they say, Catholics teach, that from the time of Christ all the way through to now, they have a bishop. So Peter ordained somebody who became the pope, and other bishops were ordained, and then they ordained other bishops and so on, so that they call that apostolic succession. They claim that. Orthodox, Greek Orthodox claim that, as well as the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Episcopalian or Anglican Fellowship claim that. They're the only ones that claim that. Lutherans do not claim that because Luther never rose to the rank of bishop. Therefore, all people who were ordained under him were ordained by a man who was an elder but not a bishop. Jason.
As to a pope, or is a pope ordained? A pope
is maybe ordained to a position or set apart for a position, but he's already been a bishop. That when the pope is ordained, if he's not a bishop already, he's ordained to the rank of bishop.
And then, is he ordained pope, though?
I think he has his hands laid on. I think he has a ceremony naming him that. He's selected by the Cardinal College of Cardinals. As far as the actual ordination of him, I'm not sure. Amanda?
Is it more of a coronation?
I can't hear.
Is it more of a coronation?
Coronation. More than an ordination. Because he's named that. He's already a priest or already a bishop. If he hasn't, he goes through all those ranks to a bishop right away. If he's not a bishop, then he has to be named or made a bishop. The bishop, he's called the Bishop of Rome. He is of no higher rank than any other bishop, but he has the authority that's greater as far as the ministerial rank. So here you see bishops doing ordinations of individuals on my laptop PowerPoint presentation. The priesthood. Okay, here's what they say about the priesthood. The priesthood is imposed by the laying on of hands of a bishop. So, again, laying on of hands of a bishop, this continues the unbroken line of apostolic succession. Bishop ordaining bishop ordaining bishop. Methodists didn't start with a priest, was a bishop. So, therefore, John Wesley was not a bishop when he started ordaining others. Therefore, they are not considered ordained properly. Holy orders is a sacrament that confers blessings of rank upon deacons, priests, and bishops. So, again, holy orders is that sacrament. The Pope is currently Benedict the 16th, and he is called the Bishop of Rome. An archbishop is a bishop, with more administrative responsibilities. We talked about him being over several districts. If you wanted to put it on a plane that we could understand here, not that we're saying that Mr. Franks is the Pope, but let's say religiously, Mr. Franks is over ministerial services. Mr. Franks has several men helping him as ministerial team. He has three men, Dennis Luker, Mr. Register, and Mr. Horchak, help him in that capacity in ministerial services. They would be like archbishops. Then you have regional pastors who would be like bishops. They have a certain area of the country where the other three men kind of look after several areas. I don't know if they have specific areas that they look after, but they help out in any area. So they have administrative responsibilities over several areas, if that would help clarify it. Not that they are that. Cardinal is one who's been given more responsibilities but is not higher in rank than a bishop. He has more responsibilities administratively and usually is attached to the Vatican. Here you see, I just put that in. I was noticing I didn't have a picture in this particular PowerPoint presentation of the new pope. But on the left, you see Pope Benedict XVI. And on the right, you see the late Pope John Paul II on the right. He was how many years was he there? Long time, 25, 35 years, whatever. He was there a long time. Pope Benedict XVI probably will not be there quite as long. He's old already. There you see Pope John Paul II. There you see Pope John the 23rd, who was a jovial man in the middle, and Pope Pius the 12th on the right, looking pretty austere. Here you see an archbishop on the left, and again, archbishops, you will usually have a little more, a little more spaghetti or trappings on their costumes. Archbishop on the left, you see Cardinal Law, Boston's Cardinal Law in the center, and you see a bishop on the right. I don't identify who he is. But you see the trappings on them all, and usually a cardinal wears a red skull cap. Here you see cardinals. Now, that's the Pope on the left, former Pope, meeting with cardinals. The cardinals are usually wearing red, not necessarily because they like the St. Louis baseball team. Here you see some Catholic priests, different garb that they wear, and Catholic priests wear quite a few different colors throughout the year. Mostly they would wear black, but they also, in their traditional dress that they would dress in public, is usually in black. But when they perform services, they many times wear green or white or other colors as well, depending on the season. Here you see deacons. They're deacons in their church. Again, is a rank to which a person may be ordained. And by the way, deacons may be married in certain circumstances, but if they ever hope to be more than a deacon, then they would have to be celibate. All right. One of my relatives was an archdeacon. They could not make him one of my relatives in the Greek Orthodox Church was an archpriest. He was such a good priest for them, they really liked him over Pittsburgh, a big congregation in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but because he was a married man in the Greek Orthodox Church, you can be married and be a priest, but you can't be a bishop and be married. So because he was married, he couldn't be made a bishop, so he was just made an archpriest as kind of a giving him a designation, you are a super priest or whatever you want to call it, a higher priest than that. Here you find deacons who are more like our elders. The deacons in their church are more like our elders. They do help with services. Take a look at the priesthood. The priesthood has two chief powers. Again, when a person becomes a priest, they have two chief powers, and that is, number one, to turn the bread and wine at the Eucharist into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. So that's a power that they have, to turn the body, the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. And then secondly, to absolve a person from his or her sins in the confessional. Two chief powers they have, to forgive sins or to absolve a person of his sins in the confessional, and two, to turn the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Christ. Priests take a vow of celibacy, which means they will not marry. Now, if you don't marry, you should not have sex. But if you have sex with a vow of celibacy, while you have sinned, you have not broken your vow. You understand? You have sinned, but you have not broken your vow. Where a nun takes a vow of poverty and chastity, and when she has sex, she has broken her vow. It's a very serious thing. Yes?
So you would say that the Catholic
believe
breaking the vow is breaking?
Well, you're breaking a commitment, so you add to the sin. They're both sins, but if you break the question was, if you break a vow, is that greater than a sin? In the sense that you not only have slipped and stumbled, you've also broken a commitment that you made, before God. It has to do with your profession. Celibacy is believed to be a holier state than marriage. Holier state than marriage. Ordination puts an indelible mark on that person's soul. We talked about that when we talked about sacraments before. It puts an indelible mark on his soul, even if he's disfellowshipped or leaves the church or whatever else. He can still perform a priestly duty in times of an emergency because he still has that indelible mark. So I guess down in hell, if a priest turns away, everybody will recognize him by the indelible mark on his soul and be able to say, "You were a priest. What are you doing down here?" Okay, if he doesn't make it. Here you see the two chief powers of the priesthood. I'm illustrating it. There's wine, a chalice of wine, and two wafers on the one side. That's the power of turning the wine and the bread into the body and blood of Christ, the blood and body of Christ. And then also on the right side, you see one person confessing. There's usually that little grill there, so you can't really see the priest on the other side. And he's hearing the confession of that person who says, "It's been so many weeks, so many days, so many months since I confessed, and here's what I've done in the meantime, here's what I've done." And they even tell you in my Catholic faith, that if you can't remember something, if you didn't do anything in the last couple of weeks, just repeat something you did before. I mean, that doesn't even sound right, but they're supposed to go through a very serious searching of themselves before they do the confession. Becoming a priest. Here's what happens when a person wants to become a priest. Signs that a person is interested. They must be capable of living habitually in a state of grace. Okay, so you must be capable of living in a state of grace. Secondly, to become a priest, you must be attracted to becoming a priest and show it by devotion to the Mass and service in and to the Church. And he does not let attraction to the opposite sex develop. So how would you know? Well, this person's there every week. You see him every week. He's there. He offers to help out. Maybe he's an altar boy. You've seen him go. He doesn't go out with the girls. He just kind of keeps to his own. He's nice to them, but he keeps his distance. Doesn't seem let attraction to the opposite sex develop. Interesting. When you suppress that, what might you develop? What might you develop? What type of attraction might you develop? You might develop attraction to the same sex if you suppress that. This lady brings out interesting part, which she brings out about celibacy, talking about what celibacy means. And she said that it actually makes them less than men. Said the real consequent upon forced clerical celibacy is its enervating effect upon the bodily and mental faculties. It saps all the vigor of manhood from those who must employ the continual force of mind and will against the natural bodily urge. Its victims have to confess that far from being free from the sexual urge, it actually breeds a very ferment of impurity in the mind. It is the boast of the Roman Catholic Church that priestly celibacy makes its clergy something more than men, that it makes them supernatural, almost angelic. The simple people readily believe this. In truth, it makes them somewhat less than men. That's Lorraine Bettner in this book, Roman Catholicism. Okay, another point, becoming a priest, they have the desire to be saved and want to save others. So they really they want to do their best to be saved, come to salvation, and they want to help others do it. They have the desire to succeed in their studies in seminary, so they have to go to school. And finally, they have the acceptance of the bishop of his diocese. So the bishop of the person's diocese must send them into and recommend them to that particular school to become a priest. Requirements to receive holy orders. So if a person's going to be ordained, here's what they say. Not 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, which we would say. 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1 is very specific. You know, a man could do a lot of things to be a minister himself, but you know what you could never do is have a good wife, and what you could never do is have good children by yourself. Can't do it. If you're not a good father, if you're not a good family man, if you're not a good husband, if you don't have a good wife, too bad. You may have a great intellect, but if you don't have character to go along with that intellect, it's not gonna count anything. You have to be hospitable. You have to be able to teach, to get a point across. Again, another requirement in 1 Timothy and Titus. So Titus 1, 1 Timothy 3. But here, their requirements are, person is of good character, good will, virtuous conduct, and good sense. Secondly, they must be at least 24 years of age, have 4 years of college and 4 years of theology at the seminary. So they must go through a pretty rigorous program in order to become a priest. They must be sincere in their devotion to the ministry. And the bishop must endorse him. Again, the bishop must say, yes, this man is cut out for the ministry. Now here's Pope Innocent III. I think I have in here, did I bring it with me? I think I have it. Let me see if I can read it to you. Yes. Let me read to you about Pope Innocent III. Don't be deceived by the name. Pope Innocent III, this comes from Haley's Handbook, page 686. Innocent III, 1198 to 1216. Most powerful of all the popes, he claimed to be vicar of Christ, vicar of God. Vicar means in place of, or vice regent to, or instead of. Vicar of Christ, vicar of God, supreme sovereign over the church and the world. The right to depose kings and princes that, quote, all things on earth and in heaven and in hell are subject to the vicar of Christ himself. I could make a decree. All right, I'm here at this class. I'm the instructor of this class. I can never do anything wrong. When I teach this class, I can never do anything wrong. I make that decree. Now it's binding. So you say, well, I thought you did something wrong. No, I can never do anything wrong. Why? Because I made that decree. Don't you know there's a decree? Who made it? I did. Well, it's nice to proclaim yourself over the whole world and over everything in heaven. And in earth, okay? This is what he proclaimed. This is part can be researched and found. He brought the church into supreme control of the state. Kings of Germany, France, England, practically all the monarchs of Europe obeyed his will. He even brought the Byzantine Empire under his control. Though his brutal treatment of Constantinople resulted in further alienation of the East. Never in history has any one man exerted more power. He ordered two crusades, decreed transubstantiation, that's the changing of the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Christ. He confirmed auricular confession, that's where people come and verbally confess. To the priest. He declared that Peter's successor, this is what I mentioned to you, Peter's successor can never in any way depart from the Catholic faith. Now, if I stood up in the congregation and said, I'm the minister here, and I'm going to tell you I can never fall away. I'm making a decree for this church, this congregation, I can never fall away. Can you do that? How do you do it? What type of ego must you have to do that or assume you have that power? But anyway, he said, Peter's successor can never in any way depart from the Catholic faith. He decreed papal infallibility. He condemned the Magna Carta. He forbade the reading of the Bible in the vernacular. He's the one that said you can't read the Bible. He ordered the extermination of heretics. He instituted the Inquisition. He ordered the massacre of the Albigenses. More blood was shed under Pope Innocent III, under his direction, and that of his immediate successors than in any other period of church history, except in the papacy's effort to crush the Reformation in the 16th and 17th centuries. One would think Nero the beast had come to life in the name of the Lamb. It's from Halley's Handbook. So that's Pope Innocent III. I already read this. It's in your handout. Question. What does the Bible teach regarding the elders of God's church? What does it teach about them? First Timothy. That they should be married. The husband of one wife. Now, they don't have to be, but they may be. The husband of one wife. Not many wives, one wife. And that her children should be not unruly. Their children should be reared in the faith. Now, you can't make those children be converted, but you can make them be civil. They should not be running around attacking the lectern, banging on the piano at church. Not if the minister is doing his job. He should be taking care of his children. They should be an example to others. Mind you, many a minister's kid, and some of you are minister's kids, and some of you have just recently become a minister's kid. You're immediately put in a different category. Well, why are you doing that? Your dad's a minister. They expect that because you preach the truth that it automatically rubs off on people. So you're put into almost a glass house. And then, yet, young people also expect that minister's kids will be like them. Well, what, you're goody two-shoes? You're not going to come do what we're going to do as we act out? Oh, I guess maybe I should act out. And then when you act out, then the mother condemns you. Well, you're the minister's kid. You shouldn't have been acting out. I mean, my kid doesn't have to do quite everything right, but you should. I did a whole paper. Actually, I did a survey many years ago on the PK, preacher's kid. One of the biggest problems that comes up is that their peers expect them to be like them, and the parents of the peers expect that kid to be perfect. And it really puts a lot of pressure on them. And ministers' kids many times get used to being neglected, get used to being passed over, get used to not having their parents live up to their promises, because oftentimes promises go awry when emergencies come up with the church. Sometimes they do feel neglected. But what does the Bible teach? 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 also teaches in 1 Peter 5 that a minister is not supposed to lord it over the brethren. A minister is supposed to care for the brethren. Does that mean he doesn't have any authority? Of course not. He has authority. The Bible teaches that quite clearly. Paul exercised that authority. He said, how do you want me to come? Do you want me to come with love, or do you want me to come with a rod? Now, a rod is also love, because when you spank people, you don't do it because you hate them. You do it because you love them. When people are disciplined, it's not done because you hate them. You're trying to get revenge upon them. It's done because you love them. And you hope that whatever punishment that comes their way, they will be able to deal with and work out, and will help them in the long run. So what does the Bible teach? 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 gives the examples, tells us what to look for in a ministry. And thank God for Paul. Otherwise, we as today would not know what to look for in a minister. And he should be proven. He should not be young. Should not be too young. Even though many of us were young, 22 and 23 year old. But if you had to travel all the distances we traveled, many of them died. Mr. Blackwell, he had traveled all over the place, Chicago. Raymond McNair had St. Louis, Chicago, and I think Milwaukee, three church circuit. You know how far that was? Some people gave up afterwards. Ministers who followed him, I can't do it. It can't be done. St. Louis had to be separated off. It's a great distance away. From St. Louis to Bloomington's 175 miles. From Bloomington up to Chicago's another close to 100. So you're doing 275 miles between St. Louis and Chicago, and we didn't have superhighways back then, just Route 66. And to try to go three services, and I've done three services once when I first went out as a trainee, and I was pooped, okay? We started off in Milwaukee, which we drove up to on a Friday evening, and then those are the days of three-hour sermons. So it was a three-hour sermon. Mr. Pinelli talked about three-hour sermons. It was a three-hour sermon. So it was over about 10:30. People then visited for a while because you don't want to show you're not friendly. You visit until about 11. You get back, you go to sleep. You've got to get up early in the morning because now you've got to drive about an hour and a half to 2 hours back to Chicago, where you had I think we went to LaGrange, in Illinois, Chicago, Illinois area, for morning services. Went to morning services there. After morning services there, we jumped in the car and drove to South Bend, Indiana, where we finished our particular day of activity. And I think there was even a social or a spokesman's club or something that evening. And then by the time we got back, I was dead. I was dead. I still remember the place where I was staying for that short time because I ended up being in St. Louis. But I flew into Chicago. That was my first weekend or second weekend there. And I mean, it was exhausting. And a lot of our ministers burned themselves out in the saddle of an automobile, driving, you know, million miles, whatever, over the course of their ministry or more. It's not easy. But the dedication was there. So they should be proven, and that way they have experiences as well. So 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1 is what we would say regarding elders of the church. Okay, what are the nuns? Nuns are the labor force for the church. The labor force for the church. Let me read to you about nuns. Comes from Lorraine Bettner. The nun is one of the most remarkable products of the Roman Catholic Church. She's an absolute slave, one whose willingness to offer her life should fill communist leaders with jealousy, one from whom the hierarchy conceals her slavery by the wedding ring on her finger, one who believes that in shining the bishop's shoes, waiting on his table, or scrubbing the floor, that she is gathering herself treasure in heaven. She is the one who makes possible the church's hundreds of hospitals, the one who teaches in its thousands of parochial schools and orphanages, the one who, with her 156,000 sisters at that time in the world, in 1952, does the drudgery behind the scenes in the hierarchy's drive to make America Catholic. She is also a woman with all the desires, instincts, loyalties, and hatreds of which a woman is capable, subservient, quote, to her man, unquote, through her indoctrination of her wedding to Christ, often catty and gossipy toward her sister nuns and hospital nurses, maternal in her hoverings over priests and children, because she has no children of her own, matriarchal in her petty policies for control of her hospital or convent, and magnificent in her spirit of abasement, poverty, and self-annihilation in behalf of God and the Roman Catholic Church. In many seminaries in the United States, nuns living in walled-off sections to prevent contact with priests or seminarians spend their lives performing domestic services of cooking, laundry, and cleaning while the others are going to school. During the persecutions of the Roman Catholic Church in Mexico, in recent decades, many sought refuge in the United States. Bishop of Tucson, the Most Reverend Daniel Gerke, offered some of them refuge in his Episcopal mansion. He dispensed with his servants. The Mexican nuns took over all the household duties. If he merely rang a bell, a nun slipped in with bowed head to receive his orders and on bended knee, kissed his Episcopal ring in appreciation for the privilege. As a dinner guest in his home, I personally witnessed this scene. It comes from People's Padre, pages 107 and 108. They're just total servants there. It makes possible Catholic Church to do much and still have lots of wealth because they can't be paid for anything. Goes on to say there are 100,000 nuns in the world living in strict seclusion in convents. Subsisting in these retreats are nuns who have retired behind closed doors for life. For life. Young women who accept the vows of the cloistered nuns renounce their homes, their loved ones, their families, never to see them again. They will stay behind bars for the rest of their lives, shut away from the world. Talks about severe discipline is inflicted upon these nuns by the Mother Superior. Flagellation, mortification of the body is practiced. Self-inflicted suffering is for the purpose of gaining indulgences by works, a striving to achieve salvation by merits. These poor souls are taught that they are putting treasures in the bank of indulgences for others. And it goes on to talk about how insanity among priests and nuns compared with the general population ratio of 595 per 100,000 is nearly double, with 1,000 per that same general population. Talks about the truth is, why do they enter these convents? Why do they go to these places? Because many times they are recruited. Various priests and various congregations get money get more blessings and more benefits thrown their way, depending on how many people go into the vocations. That is, how many decide to become a priest or how many decide to become a nun. And if they can have more from their congregation going in that direction, they get more favors and they are recruited. And also, once a person is selected as a nun, let's say Tiffany, I pick on Tiffany. Tiffany's had a broken love affair with Taylor, and therefore she comes to confess to me that she's had some great problem. So I say, Tiffany, you need to get your life straightened out. I know you're brokenhearted. Men can be beasts, you know. Maybe you should think about dedicating your life to the one man who would never let you down, that's Jesus Christ. Why don't you go visit our convent, because Sister Stephanie will show you around, and Stephanie uses all of her gestures and shows you this, shows you that, and leads you around to show you everything, and they treat you really nice, and you feel at peace, and you don't have to worry about guys asking you for a date, and you don't have to worry about it, and they teach you to have solace in Christ, and they show you a nice room and a nice place. And so, you know, you're impressed. They really try to wine and dine them. And then after that, then they get you to make your commitment. But in the meantime, here's what happens in the church. Tiffany's at Sister Stephanie's convent. While she's gone, I as the priest say, guess what? I've got great news. Our wonderful friend Tiffany has decided to become a nun, is exploring the possibilities. Now her parents qualify. And Mr. and Mrs. Giddens, you're such wonderful people that to raise a daughter like this who wants to serve God. And every week I mention this. So now, if Tiffany decides to back out, her parents feel like rot, like dirt. And so the pressure's put on in that way. At least that's what this book portrays. Okay, let's take a look at these nuns. And once she gets there, then gradually she signs everything over, and I keep giving favors to the family, making comments about them, making what a great sacrifice this is. And I bring them a sense of pride, which makes it harder for her to break it. Nuns, they form the labor force for the church. We mentioned that. They take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. That's the one I forgot. Poverty, chastity, and obedience. So let's look at the next one. Nuns change their identity to break their old ties. So basically, they're given another name. She would no longer be called Tiffany. She'd be called Marianne. Marianne. So they call her Sister Marianne. Where's Tiffany? We don't have anybody here named Tiffany. So if they wanted to lose her, could lose her real fast and sign her to a convent somewhere far away. Initially, they wouldn't do that. Okay. So they change their identity to break their old ties. Correspondence is censored. So whatever you write, whatever you receive is read by the Mother Superior to make sure that you're not writing bad things about the convent, to make sure people aren't trying to entice you away. The one girl who became a member of our church, who was going to be a nun when she met afterwards and was engaged to and married this guy, but her father did not want her to be a nun. And he was a farmer, and he would bring groceries there, and somehow or another she was working in the kitchen, and he found out when she was, and so he'd go there, and just her seeing him finally was enough to pull her out of there before she made her final vows. But I said to her, what do you do when you have to pray for hours a day when you're supposed to meditate and be quiet? What are you doing there? I said, what do you think about when you're meditating? She said, anything that comes into my mind. She wasn't meditating on any specific. What did you do during that time? And I'm sure that's not necessarily true of everybody, but that's what she did. Nuns are considered the bride of Christ and the wife of Christ. Nuns are in subjection to the priests. And the Pope is overall in charge of the nuns. So the Pope has supreme direction over all the nuns. I'll give you one more section and then we'll break. A diocese, a Catholic region of congregations, rewards a priest in a particular congregation based on how many members of his congregation join one of the vocations. So everybody that comes out of here, like Tiffany, who wants to become a nun or a priest or a brother or a sister or a brother, you help me to get some benefit from the Pope, okay, if you're willing to do that. Anyway, I'm teasing you. When a girl goes to confess her sins before a priest, she becomes vulnerable to the suggestion of becoming a nun. See, what this Lorraine Bettner points out is the reason people can go to become nuns is that priest knows them when they're vulnerable. Now, I'm sure many choose it just because they think it's a great thing. They had teachers at schools that were, and they're great growing up, good teachers and nice teachers. And there are, you know, not every nun is going to be one that seems to be a little bit crusty or something, but nice looking and nice and friendly and polite and kind. And I'm sure there's a whole range of personalities among them. And they say, wow, I want to become a teacher. I want to become a nun like you. You know, and so they, you know, it's a great profession. They talk about it and so on. So the girl, when she goes to the priest, she becomes vulnerable to the suggestion of becoming a nun. Because he knows, and of course he knows all of what's going on with her life and knows her when she is in that vulnerable position. Parents of a young woman who chooses to become a nun are given special attention and praised in the church. And again, it makes it hard. Here you are, if you quit being a nun now, your parents will get all this shame attached to them as a result. Parents who try to prevent a child from becoming a nun may be guilty of mortal sin. So if they try to get her back, they may be guilty of mortal sin. All right, I'm going to stop there. It's 25 after. Give you my 5, 10 minutes. Come back at 25 till, and we'll try to wrap this up. Stephanie, are you recruiting for your convent? Stephanie has a question. Nuns. Are we being recorded again? Here's the process of becoming a nun, so you can know how a person actually becomes a nun. I know you're excited, especially after the last time we talked about what people do. Process. Number one, they're a postulant. This is someone who's asking or seeking to be a nun. It usually lasts for a year. Call it a postulant. They go to the convent and they receive their training. Secondly, the second part is a novitiate, the name, N-O-V-I-T-I-A-T-E, and it is a novice for 1 to 2 years. She is then given a white veil as a symbol of new life and given a new name. Now as her name changes, Sister So-and-so. Thirdly, there's an 8-day retreat, prayerful silence. She examines her inner self. Remember the movie Sound of Music. Remember what Maria was doing after she felt rebuffed by Georg. When she came back to the convent, the kids came to try to see her, and she said, I'm sorry, she's not available. So I would take it that was probably this 8-day retreat where she prayerful silence. She examines her inner self either to accept becoming a nun or returning to the world. Remember, she was trying to do her final test. And then number four, she becomes a junior sister. She receives the black veil of a nun and takes a vow for 1 year. After that, she may renew her vow or return to the world. So they want to make sure they want to stay there. Now, this continues for 3 to 5 years, the renewal. And then finally, number five, she becomes a full-fledged sister, and she takes a vow for life. So they do, modern day, they do allow them more time than what Lorraine Bettner presented. Modern day, and that comes from one of their booklets on nuns. Okay, here you see cloistered nuns. And on the left and on the right, cloistered nuns, where they have to have their services by themselves. I think a priest comes in to help them out. Look at this place. Again, cloistered nuns, kind of a bare bones type of a room. And there they are up in the hills and the mountains away from other people. And here, an early convent gives the impression of austerity. So this is an early convent and how it basically was, in spite of the fact it looks run down, it also looks austere. Here's the cloistered nun. Cloistered nuns believe that their vocation is to witness to others the power of prayer, even when others don't know that prayers are offered for them. So that they're praying for peace. They're praying for the well-being of the poor children of the world. When it becomes known that these sisters are devoting time for them, it is comforting. So somehow or another, people will find out these sisters are praying for them. Nuns wear a plain gold band with the name Jesus inscribed inside, not only the cloistered nuns, all nuns, with the name of Jesus inscribed inside as a sign of their permanent commitment to their vows. So they have a gold band. There are about 100,000 cloistered nuns in the world. They live in seclusion for the remainder of their lives. Locked away, basically. They choose to be. They usually take other vows of silence or vows to go barefooted. So they take a vow of silence in which they don't speak to anybody, except maybe for a short 1 hour or whatever a day. Or they make the one set of cloistered nuns takes a vow to go barefooted. Summer, winter, fall, whatever, wherever they go, they're in their bare feet, called the barefooted nuns. I guess by suffering some austerity, they're racking up indulgence points. Between 500 and 1200 A.D., all nuns lived in a cloister. Now, my heart goes out. Can you think? You think of a group of women who want to dedicate themselves religiously to serving God, and this is how they end up having a profession or a vocation, what they end up actually doing. Cloistered nuns will never see their families again. Like other nuns, they are given a different name, and the Mother Superior is in complete charge. And I've read things about what happens. There was a book out called Maria Monk, which talked about what goes on in a convent and how and some of the cattiness of people and how there's this, that, and the other thing going back and forth, because you have a number of women living with each other, all wanting to have that maternal feeling and trying to get along, which is not easy to do. Flagellation and other hurtful acts upon the body are performed. These and other self-inflicted sufferings are to gain indulgences by works to save themselves and others from the tortures of purgatory. Insanity among nuns and priests was nearly twice that of the general public. I mentioned that. Schizophrenia is also a frequent mental disorder among institutionalized priests and those of the vocations. Schizophrenia. Why? Because you have to become somebody else in order to cope. That happens often. Sometimes it's self-induced. Yes. Beating yourself with a whip or some type of usually cords or taking cords and beating yourself with a rope. I'm sorry, yeah, from the flagellum. Here you see a nun's cell, very plain on the left side, just very bare bones, little table, little chair, little bed. And she's kneeling in prayer. And on the right side, nuns just taking a walk in the woods. But orderly. Everything you have comes from them. You own nothing when you take that vow of poverty and chastity and obedience. Here are dedicated cloistered nuns, the free workforce of the Catholic Church. Those are black nuns serving in probably a section of Africa, I believe, or West Indies. Nuns doing their devotions in a convent. You see all of them standing there doing their devotions. Some of them go through certain things, say the Hail Marys, the rosary beads, and so on. Question, why don't we have nuns in our church? Why don't we have nuns? Jason? Well, Priscilla certainly was a serving lady. And we do have deaconesses, but we don't have nuns. Sarah? It's a very good answer. Proverbs 31 talks about a virtuous woman. The virtuous woman is not a single lady. She has a husband. She has family. She's out buying things. She's not off on her own. Very good answer. What other reason why don't we have nuns?
It's just an unnatural way of life.
Yeah, it's not a natural way of life. I think in that type of condition, people could be easily taken advantage of, where someone is taught that they have to be totally submissive to someone else, and they owe everything to someone else because you don't have anything. I mean, it'd be like Tiffany not having anything. Everything she would eat, she'd have to get approval of. She'd have to get approval if she's going to go eat, time to eat. You can't just go have that by yourself. You have to get approval for those things. You know, there's a constriction of that person's life. Mitch? Yeah, if everybody were nuns, there'd be less choice for the guys. That's right. It's a very good reason not to have nuns. What other reason? Justin? Yeah, the fellowship issue is big, and how do you show that? Now, they believe, the ones who are locked up believe that they are availing more by prayer than anything else. So they see themselves availing through prayer, and that's why they do that. And also, by taking all this pain and punishment, that they might be helping people save them punishment in purgatory, because they can, since they do it so often, I mean, you're in pain all the time, since you're living such an austere life, you're putting a lot of merits of indulgences into the treasury that those people can maybe use or assign them to one of those people. See if there's anything else I want to share. There's a sharp contrast between the exhortation Rome gives to her masses to raise a large families and that given to the girl for whom the convent is in view. To the latter, virginity is held up as a perfect state and as more pleasing to God. Marriage and motherhood are spoken of disparagingly as a lower form of morality designed for the less perfect. The girl who may matrimonially be inclined is warned of the problems of home, childbearing, care of children, problems of in-laws, and annoyances of all kinds. She is told that if she turns down this offer of marriage to Christ, she will be committing a terrible sin, will have to take the consequences. Now, that's her experience with it. It talks about blighted romance provides the opportunity. Church of Rome well knows that the influence strong families can have on a nun, pulling her back to an independent life. Consequently, she's determined to make every effort to break all of her ties at home. First step to that program is change her identity. She's done it one stroke by dropping her real name, giving her a fictitious name, usually the name of some obscure saint. Then it says, experience proves, however, that a man or a woman who finds it necessary to use an assumed name often loses self-respect and with it courage and initiative. Then it goes on to talk about, it says, photographs, even of girl's mother and father, are taken away from her. For photographs are strong reminders of the old life and tend to make dying to the world harder. Her incoming and outgoing mail is censored by the mother superior. Concerning a matter of breaking relations with home and family, Liguori, the most noted moral theologian of the church, writes, if attachment to relatives were not productive of great mischief, Jesus Christ would not have so strenuously exhorted us to estrangement from them. If, he says, anyone comes and hates not his father and mother, brothers and sisters, he cannot be my disciple. Luke 14:26. Again, I came to set a man at variance against his father and a daughter against her mother. Matthew 10:35. We point out, however, that the true explanation of Luke 14 and so on is he that loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Not he that loves hate, he must actively hate his father and mother. They go on to talk about what several of them say. St. Jerome says, it's a great advantage to forget your parents, for then the king shall greatly desire your beauty. And again, how many monks have, by compassion towards their father and mother, lost their own souls? A religious who is attached to her relatives has not yet left the world. Can you imagine teaching people that? For my part, St. Teresa said, for my part, I cannot conceive what consolation a nun can find in her relatives. So all those things were done to try to help the woman stay away. Canon law requires that the girl bring her specified amount of money, property, depending on her status in life, which money is known as a dowry or marriage portion of the spouse of Christ. The money is invested, and if for any reason she leaves the convent, it must be returned to her, but not the interest that have been derived from it. So They get the money, they get her goods, and she signs it over to them when she comes on her own. So anyway, that's Lorraine Bentner. And that's a story about nuns and priests. Why don't we have them in our organization? Because God does not provide for them in the scriptures. God does provide for deaconesses and deacons to serve in the church, but they are not required to take a vow of chastity, because God says don't forbid to marry. Remember 1 Timothy 4, verse 3. Don't forbid them to marry. And secondly, poverty. God nowhere tells you that you should go around poor. He says you're poor, you'll have with you always, but he doesn't tell you to make yourself poor. You should try to become the best we can be. Okay, thank you for your attention. That finishes up priests and nuns. We just have celibacy to do. I will not be doing creation, because basically I can summarize that in one statement on Thursday. And Thursday also you'll be filling out your assessment for the class.